capitalism equals reality, is what capitalism would have you think. And is easy to get tricked, because capitalism is the million machines you are tied to, the machines you move and that move you. Capitalism penetrates you. It has your desire of freedom captive and makes money out of it too. Capitalism is hurtful, yet you reproduce it day by day. In capitalism, you are human capital, your very own boss within, antagonist within themselves, your emotions, impulses and perceptions. Yes, it can be somewhat dizzying. Think about it. If you will, then gather the fragments of your daily resistance. Draw an escape line on the running sand of society in decline, to call out for some friends, old and new, 'cause we must be more than a few, to erase that equal sign, to write an equation much more fine.
Thank you. Okay, so to the first question, how would you describe the current state of global capitalism?
Well, I'd start by saying that global capitalism did not recover, to use the mainstream term, from the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008. The financial crisis continues to circulate all over the world as it continues to circulate in Europe. The World Organization of the circuits of capitals, valorization, and accumulation continues to be in a deep crisis. We are living in a situation which is definitely characterized by the existence of something that we can call global capitalism, but there is no organization of global capitalism that is capable to guarantee a stable reproduction of the system. I was talking before of the circulation of the global financial crisis, and I think it is quite easy to see that, for instance, in the aftermath of the 2007-8 crisis, many people were talking of the BRICS as the kind of big winners of the crisis. But nowadays, the BRICS themselves are living through a deep crisis, which also challenges the very possibility of taking them as a relevant unity at the global level. Moreover, I think that independently of the differences between the monetary policies of central banks in such countries as the US or Japan, or in such a place as Europe, the so-called quantitative easing has deepened and entrenched processes of financialization of capitalism, which bear in themselves the risk of a deep instability. I would say that most of the problems that led to the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008 are not resolved. And this means that we still live in a situation which is characterized by the presence of the crisis. Climate change is, of course, a big issue. In a way, one could say that it encapsulates the big question of the limits to capitalist development, meaning that on the one hand it shows that there are concrete specific limits to the possibility of expansion without end of capitalist accumulation. But on the other hand, it also shows that capital is always able to take its own limits as a chance for further valorization of capital itself. I don't need to go into the details of so-called green capitalism, or, for instance, of the carbon emission trading, which has become a new blossoming kind of financial sector, in order to show that climate change itself is taken by capital, by calls specific capitalist actors as a chance for further valorization and accumulation. Needless to say, I mean, speaking of climate change means to take into account very general, broad issues which have to do eventually with the way in which the humankind inhabits the planet. I'm thinking now of the whole debate surrounding the topic of Anthropocene over the last years. I think these debates are particularly important, but at the same time one should not lose sight, let's say, of the short-term question that I have been discussing until now, which means this dialectic of encounter with the limit of capital and taking the limit as a kind of obstacle to be overcome, as a kind of chance for inventing new means of economic valorization of capital, of opening up new spaces for the further development and entrenchment of capital. The discussion of the topic of the Anthropocene makes us aware of the fact that this dialectic of the limit, which is in a way characteristic of modern capitalism since its inception, is nowadays kind of played out on the edge of an abyss, of an abgrund, to use the German word that is so evocative. So, I mean, let's keep in mind that capitalist development nowadays is kind of deployed against the background of this image of a possible catastrophic change of the conditions under which we live on Earth. So this is an important reminder of the futility, eventually, of all the rhetoric of economic growth, recover, and so on. It is an important reminder of the more general problem that we are confronting with nowadays, which means that we live in a world, we live within a capitalist mode of production in which development and crisis, recover and depression kind of coexist, intermingle together and define kind of temporal coordinates of our own experience.
And what about the current situation of immigration in Europe nowadays? Would you like to say a few words about that?
Yes, of course. I mean, I think that once again we have been confronted with movements and struggles of migration over the last months in Europe that kind of confirm that migration is nowadays one of the most crucial political stakes in the world. If you think of the European situation, the whole European integration process has been challenged, and in a way it has been also put into crisis by the mass movements of migration that we experienced in 2015. To put it shortly, once again, what has been called the migration crisis in Europe has confronted us with the deep ambivalence of migration. Just think of the images that we keep in mind from last year. Images of shipwrecks in the Mediterranean, images of corpses surfacing in the choppy waters of the Mediterranean, the image of a child on a Turkish shore. So these are images that speak of the violence and of the kind of domination that is at play in the so-called government of migration. I don't need to go into the details to demonstrate that violence has been kind of crucial and defining feature of the reorganization of border regimes in Europe, particularly at the so-called external frontiers of the European Union over the last two and a half decades in the wake of the Schengen Agreement. So this is the first point that we have to keep in mind. But the second point, which is also very important, is the kind of stubbornness, the kind of obstinacy of migrants in their own movement, in their own struggles, in their own way to challenge increasingly fortified borders. We have also in this regard some effective, amazing images in mind. Just think of the power with which migrants were able to challenge and eventually overcome borders across the Balkans and into Europe. Just think of the March of Freedom, the so-called March of Freedom, that was organized in late August, early September, from Budapest to Vienna, with thousands of people marching toward Austria. These are images that speak of the power of migration, of the power of migration to challenge borders, to kind of compel political, legal devices to reorganize themselves, and the power of migrants to express kind of latent claim for freedom and equality that deeply challenges the European order. So these are just, two sets of images in order to emphasize what I was calling the ambivalence of the migrant experience nowadays, that can be seen in a very effective way in Europe, but is also apparent in other borderscapes around the world. As far as Europe itself is concerned, there is also another point that needs to be emphasized, which means the fact that the movements and struggles of migration, particularly in 2015, have posited once again the problem of, let's say, the position of Europe in the world, and particularly the problem of the relation of Europe with the territories, the peoples at its multiple borders and outsides. Also from this point of view, movements and struggles of migration are a powerful and in a way effective push toward a change in the way in which Europe understands and positions itself within the world. Of course, I mean, we have also witnessed reactionary, very powerful reactionary reactions to the challenges of migration, and these reactionary kind of movements are kind of defining feature of the European predicament nowadays. The way in which we will be able to build up coalitions, movements capable of effectively challenging these reactionary movements is the big question of these months and of the next year. And it is a question we have to ask in a situation which is, of course, a very difficult situation. Just think of the Paris attacks in November and of the continuing war and the tensions in the middle, in the so-called greater Middle East. I mean, but in a way, migration helps us. The movement and struggles of migration help us to become aware of the radical nature of the challenges we are confronted with, and of the fact that these challenges are European challenges, but also involved Europe's relation with what I was calling in a metaphorical way its multiple outsides.
What do you think? What is this a possible question to answer? What connects capitalism, climate change, and immigration? How do you see this triangle?
Well, of course, there is a direct connection between climate change and immigration. If you just think of the many migratory movements that are connected to climate change. There is a whole discussion surrounding the figure of the so-called climate refugee. And there are studies that demonstrate that according to a kind of extensive interpretation of this would be legal figure, the climate refugee, in such a state like Arizona, a huge proportion of Mexican illegalized migrants would be recognized as climate refugees. This simply means that at the root of many migratory movements, for instance, in this case, from some regions of Mexico toward the south of the United States, you find climate change. So I think this is a very direct kind of link. And then, I mean, capitalism and immigration. I mean, capitalism and immigration is not a new kind of topic. I have often written in the past that there is no capitalism without migration. And this is a point that I have definitely not been the only one to make. I think it is, again, a kind of a fact that can be taken for granted. I mean, there is a deep connection between capitalism and migration. Meaning that capitalism needs mobile subjects, mobile populations. If you think of the classical definition provided by Marx of the proletarian as the bearer of labor power, Marx's definition is the definition of a mobile subject. To put it simply, I think that both historically and in the present, the mobility of labor is a kind of contested field, a field of tensions, a battleground. On the one hand, you have kind of capital's interest, which means the interest of specific capitalist actors, to have a mobile population available as a reserve of labor power, but on the other hand, you also have the kind of subjective behaviors, the kind of subjective dimension of mobility and migration. I think it is important to frame the discussion of the relation between capitalism and migration in terms of labor mobility, but I have also to add that speaking of labor mobility means to speak of a set of questions, dynamics, processes, problems that affect also the life of people who do not work. What characterizes the specific situation we are confronted with nowadays regarding this relation, this link between capitalism and migration, is the fact that in many parts of the world, migration takes place outside of a framework within which there is a kind of single situation, kind of single employment relation that shapes the whole government of labor migration. To put it simply, I explain this point with an historical reference. If you take the situation in Western Europe in the post-war decades, in the 1950s, in the 1960s, until the big crisis of 1973, you see, for instance, the guest workers programs in a country like West Germany. And you can easily see that these programs were setting a kind of norm for the government of migration. And this norm was the industrial employment relation. Migrants were recruited from such countries as Italy, as Spain, as Yugoslavia, as Turkey, in order to go to work in factories. And they were kind of subordinatedly integrated within the more general labor force at work in these factories. There were many people who migrated from the same countries without going to work in a factory, but their position, their subject position, their legal status was kind of influenced, determined by a labor migration regime that took industrial employment relations as its standard, as its norm. Nowadays, it is not so anymore. I mean, connected to the transformations of capitalism over the last decades. There is a process that I have tried to grasp with Brett Nielsen in our book, Borderless Method, speaking of a multiplication of labor, which means the explosion of the norm, the explosion of the standard, the multiplication and heterogenization of subjective labor positions, of laboring activities, of labor contracts, of labor status, and so forth. This has profound implications also for migration, because migration is in a way at the center of these processes of multiplication of labor. So if you look at the way in which migration is kind of governed nowadays, you always find a tendency toward a multiplication of statuses, a multiplication of visa, a multiplication of employment relations. In such a situation, I mean, it is much more difficult to kind of govern the turbulence and autonomy of migration. And this multiplies and intensifies the conflicts that are connected to contemporary experiences of migration under capitalism. Then there is the link between capitalism and climate change. And I mean, I think it is quite easy to see that there is an important link between capitalism and climate change, both historically, because it has been, you know, the Industrial Revolution that has changed the way in which human activity impacts upon geological time, as analysts of Anthropocene say, and in the present, regarding what I was saying before on green capitalism and carbon emission trading. Then, of course, there is another important question that is connected to the relation between climate change and capitalism, and it is the question of so-called climate justice. I mean, and the question of climate justice refers to what I was saying at the beginning on kind of structural nature of contemporary world disorder. I mean, of these continuous clashes between emerging countries, regions of the world, and you know, historical centers of capital and capitalism, but also tensions and conflicts among these emerging countries and regions that do not form anymore a unity as it was maybe only in the rhetoric, but also in the politics of the so-called Third World.
Thank you.
How would you describe the forms of capitalist oppression people have to face nowadays in the everyday life, and how that has been changing in the recent past?
You know, this is a very general question, but also a very important question. It is a very important question also in order to discuss the future of what you call emancipatory movements. I am convinced that capitalism underwent a profound change over the last decades, which means that the daily experience of capitalist oppression and exploitation has changed correspondingly. To put it very shortly, I mean, the kind of hypothesis I am currently trying to develop with several friends, among them again Brett Nilsson, is that contemporary capitalism is characterized by the prevalence of what we call extractive operations, by the prevalence of an extractive logics. And when we talk of extractive logics, of extraction, we don't simply think of the continuing relevance of, let's say, literal extraction, I mean mining or agribusiness within the general working of contemporary capitalism. We are also trying to describe through the concept of extraction other capitalist operations, particularly as far as finance is concerned. If you think of finance, you are usually confronted with images and theories that present finance as self-referential, money producing money. But I think there is a need to challenge this idea of the self-referential nature of finance. I agree from this point of view with the work done, for instance, by Christian Marazzi, who emphasizes the fact that nowadays we are confronted with a kind of deep intertwining between financial markets and so-called real economy. And the prevalence of finance, the kind of widespread penetration of daily life through finance corresponds to the entrenchment of the logic, which means of devices of debt. So, going back to your question, how is nowadays capitalist oppression experienced in daily life by people? I mean, it's clear that debt is an important experience of capitalist oppression nowadays. And you will know that there are important theorists, scholars, activists, friends like Maurizio Lazzarato, David Graeber, who have written extensively on this primacy of debt in contemporary capitalism. But I think it is important, to ask a question. How does debt work, which is the content, the real content of that? And basically, the answer to this question can be very, very easy. I mean, the content of that is the compulsion to work. It's the compulsion to work in order to be able to repay the debt in the future. So just think now of specific, concrete experience of debt, which means of the relation with financial capital. Let's take a kind of iconic and banal figure. A single black mother who takes on a subprime mortgage in the Bronx, in New York. This woman has a specific relationship with financial capital, which is represented by the bank, which gives her the possibility to take on this mortgage. And this can become an experience of oppression, for instance, in the case of a foreclosure. I mean, and we know that there were many, many foreclosures in the aftermath of the 2008 crisis in the US. But more generally, this relationship implies a compulsion to work. Compulsion to work in order to be able, as I was saying before, to repay the debt. So let's follow this single black woman. I repeat, it's a kind of banal and iconic figure, where she goes out of the bank. What does she do? She looks for an employment or for a way to earn money in order to be able to go back to the bank next month and to repay the part of the debt. I mean, and she can do whatever work she wants. I mean, she can go to a factory and enter another relationship with another capitalist actor, an industrial capitalist. She can go into a bar and enter into different kind of relationships. She can, I mean, become a dealer. She can sell drug in on the road. I mean, and she enters another set of relationship. So you will see that I am trying to give you a very banal and mundane image of what I was describing before in abstract terms as the multiplication of labor. Because to the prevalence, to the increasing relevance of financial operations within the general shape of contemporary capitalism, this situation corresponds, in which a multiplicity of laboring activities are possible, are available, in order to satisfy the claims of financial capital. So financial capital is a kind of accumulation of claims and titles on a future wealth, on a wealth to be produced in the future. And I'm just quoting from Capital, Volume 3 of Karl Marx, although there is a need, I mean, to update his analysis, of course. But this emphasis on the relation between financial capital and a wealth to be produced in the future through labor, through social cooperation, seems to me a very important kind of contribution, which is nowadays still useful. From this point of view, I think, or I hope, that it is easy to understand in which terms we try to speak of finance as extraction. I mean, because finance does not have, financial capital does not have any kind of employment relationship with its subjects, And nevertheless, the continuity of financial accumulation is predicated upon the continuity of labor and social cooperation. So, this social cooperation in the future is precisely the kind of productive power from which finance anticipates the extraction of its value. So, from this point of view, I think I have at least tried to answer your question. Nowadays, experiences of capitalist oppression, exploitation, are multiple and diverse. And at the same time, they are kind of overdetermined by the prevalence of what I have tried to define in terms of extractive operation of capital, particularly as far as finance is concerned.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's go to the last question, question number three, four, I mean. So, about the emancipatory movements, like I have written here. So how do you see the future of like getting organized, of organization, of organizing within the emancipatory movements?
Well, first of all, I think it is important to say that people exploited, dominated people struggle at the level of everyday life against exploitation, domination, and oppression. They don't wait for leftist scholars or activists in order to get organized and to struggle. But of course there is a problem in kind of political definition of the perspective of a struggle for, let's say, freedom and equality in their in their structural connection in the present. We have witnessed many important experiences of emancipatory movements over the last years. I don't think it makes sense now to go into the details of specific experiences. Maybe it is more useful to say something very general on the perspective of a political kind of confluence between diverse struggles and movements. We had, for instance, the Occupy movement in 2011, a movement that spread from the southern shore of the Mediterranean, from Tunisia, from Egypt, across Spain and other European countries, to the US and other parts of the world. That was a very important movement in which crucial experiences of organization were made, and I don't think that these experiences went lost with the end of specific occupations. I mean, they kind of build an archive that is available for contemporary struggles and movements. I think what is particularly important nowadays is to raise again the question of organization. And the question of organization is also the question of temporal continuity of struggles and movements. And it is particularly the development and crisis of the Occupy movement that compels us to rethink the question of organization. The question of organization is also the question of building up institutions capable of guaranteeing the reproduction, continuity, the multiplication of power of struggles and movements. I am convinced that nowadays we must take into account the diversity, the heterogeneity of social struggles as a kind of constitutive element of that comes out of the very composition of labor that corresponds to contemporary capitalism in many parts of the world. So the big problem is to imagine and to construct forms of organization, forms of institutional connection that can valorize this diversity and heterogeneity of social struggles and movement. I speak of institutional arrangements, and of course I do not refer only to existing institutions. I think it is very important to look at the way in which movements and struggles are able to produce their own institutional forms, their own autonomous institutions. But at the same time, I also think that there is a need to rethink the relation between social movements and struggles on the one hand and existing institutions on the other hand. We had very important experiences in this regard over the last 10, 15 years. Just think of Latin America. But just think also of Greece or of such Spanish cities as Barcelona, Madrid, Cádiz. I think that also these experiences form a part of what I was calling before the archive of forms and experiences, of languages, of notions, of tools that is available nowadays for people who are interested in the future of getting organized within emancipatory movements. These experiences are profoundly ambivalent. They do not provide any model. Nevertheless, I think that there is a need to think through these experiences precisely in order to imagine and construct the organizational, institutional forms that allow us to stabilize the conquests of specific social movements and struggle in order to build a more advanced ground for the continuation of social struggles. I mean, this raises, of course, a lot of problems. I mean, it raises the problem of the relation between reform and revolution in completely new ways. I think these are some of the most important problems we have to tackle in the next future.
Yes, thank you very much for the interview.
You're welcome.